What do zombies, Motaba, and a guzzling wasteland have in common? They're just like COVID-19.
Join us for Apocalypse Now as we review some of the best and worst pandemic, post-apocalyptic, and general end-of-the-world films and relate them to today's current situation.
Give us a listen. We might just save your life and then share it with a friend. Or don't. Whatever. It's not the end of the world.
Join Scott.
And Callum.
And Dez every Friday for a new episode
of Apocalypse Now, because you never know.
Hello?
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 If you can hear this, it's not too late. I've returned to warn you. This is Time Pop, a podcast that discusses time travel and pop culture. There are spoilers. I've seen the future, and nothing is sacred to these folks. Your past, present, and future are sure to be ruined. Even if you could go back in time, as I have, you will never forget what you are about to hear. You've been warned. This is Time Pop.
Ari and I were talking, and as all those are superhero ones are ones I should like be a part of. So if that's too much Scott, I can sit this one out.
And I said there's never too much Scott.
Oh, there can be too much.
No way. We can turn this into a tripodcast anytime you guys are ready.
You're a tripodcast.
Welcome, Chrononauts, as we guide you through the experience of time travel using pop culture as our rock of pure evil. We will be your constants. I am Dez.
And I'm Ari.
And this is
Time
Pop.
Time Pop.
Time Pop.
Is that your pop sound?
I tried to do a pop. I'm trying to give Desmond the plosives. He like, I just wanted to give you a huge pop.
Can't do it. I solved your problem. I've blocked your pops.
We are
today.
Oh, okay.
Oh, Ari, what you got?
I was gonna say we are lucky enough to have Scott Lifton in the studio today.
Oh, it's so good to be in the time travel studio. It feels like I've traveled back in time to be here. Such a pleasure to see you both. You're looking well. Like time hasn't affected either of you.
Oh. Except for this. Look at this.
Oh, facial hair growth.
That's
folks at home. He's got the quarantine beard happening.
I know. I've been doing such a good job of showering and getting out of my jammies that I had to let something go. So there it is. Scott Lifton, straight off the critically acclaimed, certified fresh. Recently canceled rotten popcorn.
Yeah, freshly canceled. Oh man, it's all, you know what's the great shows like the British Office, they just canceled after two seasons just to like quit while they were ahead.
Yeah,
some of the best athletes did the same thing. Way for us to end on top.
We peaked.
Maybe too soon.
Also, but he just didn't have time, folks, because he's too busy on the new hit podcast, Apocalypse Now.
Is that supposed to be an explosion?
That was, man, I am just not cutting it as the sound effects guy today. That was a nuclear explosion, folks. Post-apocalyptic fans, you recognize that.
That's right. Because you never know. Today, we watched Time Bandits. The, Jesus, I forgot his name. The Terry Gilliam, Jesus Christ. Okay.
Take two.
What's the word I'm looking for, Scott?
What do you
the Terry Gilliam project?
The Terry Gilliam extravaganza. It's actually part of his trilogy of imagination.
Yes, yeah. Which so written and directed by Terry Gilliam, starring John Cleese, Sean Connery, Shelley Duvall, Catherine Helmond, Ian Holm, lots of other great people, and yeah, let's jump right into that, Scott, because that, are you looking at the Wikipedia?
I might be looking at the Wikipedia thing, maybe.
Because that, I'm glad I read that early on when I started to watch this episode, because it really helped me to watch this movie through the eyes of a child, which is what he was kind of going for in there. I don't know if you read that part of the little blurb there.
Yeah, they said this is his first in the trilogy of imagination, which was followed by Brazil and Adventures of Baron Munchausen. This one, right, is Eyes of a Child. Then it was Eyes of a 30-year-old middle-aged guy, and then Baron Munchausen, which is an elder senior citizen.
Yeah, and I unfortunately have not seen either one of the other movies, and I know that makes me a failure at a movie lover. Like, Brazil especially has really just been knocking on my door for a while. I got to do that.
You should see it.
And the Munchausen one, I feel like that was in my HBO wheelhouse. So I think if I watch that, some of it's going to come screaming back to me, but I've never sat and watched it.
Yeah, I mean, this film felt like a Terry Gilliam film. He loves dealing with the imagination. He likes a little bit of insanity, and he likes like chaos and scant angles. And this film delivered in all of those aspects.
This was, and I haven't seen a lot of his early stuff, this was definitely a Monty Python movie.
Yes, it was pretty silly. And in fact, I know you guys like to break down time travel with science, and I'd love to hear how you're going to do it for this movie. Because there's no science whatsoever.
Yeah, this is just wacky. Things are happening just for a reason to happen. This is one of those movies that, like, the first half, I was, like, really paying attention and trying to take notes. And then I was just like, I don't know what the fuck is going on. And I just put my notebook down and just watched the last hour just to see if I could let it soak in.
Yeah, I feel the same way. The first half, I was totally on board. They were going through history. They were meeting people. And then all of a sudden, it completely turned into a fantasy movie.
Yeah, So, Scott, I think you have the most history with this movie, if any. I don't know if you have a grand history, but you've definitely seen this a couple times, right?
No, I have a weird...
What?
I'm a huge Terry Gilliam fan. This is a weird movie that, like, I might have seen little bits of once, and it always kind of escaped my viewing. My sister had seen this as a little kid. I remember telling me, she's like, doesn't make any sense. He picks up a piece of toast and his parents die. And it always lived in my family as this very strange film that like nobody wanted to watch. And I'm a Gilliam fan. That's why I sort of want to be a part of this, because I just been wanting to see it to finish my Gilliamhood. But I don't have a huge history with this film.
Yeah. Where does this land in his entire filmography?
Yeah. You know, I'm a big Fisher King is fantastic. Big fan of 12 Monkeys, big fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Brazil also, this one, maybe a little bit lesser in quality than certain other ones.
Yeah, I'm going to look it up here and see.
According to what I read on it, it was very high grossing for the, I'm looking right now, budget of $5 million, box office $42 million. So this like put him on the map.
So yeah, he had made The Holy Grail and then Jabberwocky before this. I don't remember Jabberwocky.
Yeah, so this is upping his game. And you know, even if you watch it, I was even watching it. The effects are not great, right? It's like very amateur in 80s, but I mean, he had to be so creative to make all those effects happen. It is very imaginative, very creative, especially for the time.
I kept waiting for it to go full Python and go animated. Like, I was really surprised that this never went animation. Like, especially when the giant walks out of the water and he's ready to stomp on that building, like, I feel like some of that might have even been animated, but he still hit it better than just going pure Python animation.
I mean, it felt like a cartoon.
Yeah. So I guess let's get into Ari's overview so we can start to kind of walk our way through this, and we'll pick it apart as we come to whatever the is going on.
You've been swearing a lot more lately.
God darn it. I know. It's that Apocalypse Now.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Those dirty, dirty apocalypse people. They have no filter.
So I'm definitely going to need some help with this overview. So a little boy, I don't know, he's probably 10.
11.
How do you know he's 11? Oh, okay. Well, he knows that the little boy is 11 because he looked it up on Wikipedia, but nowhere in the movie does he say his age. So we're going to say he's 10. And he has really weird parents. They're like not very attentive, and they're kind of self-absorbed and really into appliances, kitchen appliances. So I think he was trying to portray the parents as being bad parents. So this little boy goes to bed one night, and out of his closet jumps a knight on a horse and just destroys his room and goes through a wall. And then he wakes up, or he, you know, doesn't wake up. He realizes it didn't actually happen, which I thought was weird. That never came back into play. Why did a guy on a horse jump out of his closet and destroy his room? that never came back around.
Yeah. And then it's just, I think that's just setting up his imagination maybe.
Yeah.
At the beginning. And this 11-year-old boy has the demeanor of a 30-year-old that's been trapped at the same job for 15 years.
He's British, so there's that. Right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, I kind of took this as either a dream or a kid's imagination. But so he goes to bed the next night and he's armed with a flashlight and a satchel bag or a shoulder bag and a Polaroid camera. And is it like 5 or 6 little people come out of his closet that night and they are holding a map. And once they realize that the little boy is not. So once the little people realize that the boy whose name is Kevin is not the all-powerful being or whatever they called him, they attack him and they try to hold him down. And then
it's a very like sitcom fight.
Yeah.
Like I know they're little people, but there's still 6 of them and they seem to be like attacking him, but they're just kind of slap
holding him down.
And yeah.
So then what shows up? Was it the glowing head, the Wizard of Oz glowing head type of thing?
Didn't the knights come back for a second?
Is that what it was? Who came back?
Which part?
So after the little people tackle Kevin, you know,
the supreme being appears behind them.
Okay, so the supreme being, the floating head that looks like the Wizard of Oz head, appears and they all start to run. And the one wall of Kevin's bedroom recedes and into a long hallway. And they run into this long hallway, which I thought was a really cool effect because they built that set.
Yeah.
And that looked cool for 81 or whatever year this was.
Just real quick while we're on the year, I think, yeah, there was a big, you know, technological transformation going on in the world. And it showed his parents just, you know, with all the computers and cool stuff being invented, all they wanted was the coolest microwave ever, and you know, just kind of shows them being consumers, and that's just all they're about. And this little boy is looking for some kind of escape from what he sees as his future of just being a droned consumer.
So they go down this long hallway and they jump into a blackness, and they appear or they land in
1796.
Napoleon, that's right. They land in Italy while Napoleon is trying to conquer Italy. And we find out that the 7 little people, or not 7, were there 7? No.
There were 6, I believe.
6, okay.
And they were meant to be kind of Monty Python-ish troupe. At least at one point I read something that they were kind of written that way. And they come off, I mean, we'll get to it, but their first experience with Napoleon is them performing for him.
Right. So these 6 little people are, we learn that they are thieves, but they originally worked for the supreme being, which is talked about a lot. So I don't know. Do they ever actually say God? They keep calling him supreme being, but they essentially are alluding to that it is God.
I think they do a couple times, but they're usually cut off. Like, you know, he's the creator, but not God somehow. I don't know. Yeah.
So these 6 men worked for the supreme being building things.
Trees. You know,
trees and such. But they do talk about how the entire universe was made in 7 days, but that's a tough job. And we got tired of doing that, so they stole a map, right? We learned all this pretty early on. They stole a map that consists of the different holes that were left in the universe because everything was made in 7 days. They essentially messed up, and there's like little holes in throughout time, in throughout the universe. And there is a map that shows every hole and precisely what time it will open, like a door.
And this map has no earthly reason to actually convey that information, but they and yeah, and these holes no one seems to ever accidentally fall into one.
It's also weird, you could almost buy that a map shows certain places where there's vortexes, like rifts in space and time, but they're only open for like 30 minutes, 30 seconds. And somehow the map reveals all these holes all throughout time and how long they're open for and what times. Unlikely, not scientific.
Yeah. What do you got cooking over there, Scott?
No, it's so you can hear the beeping.
This time I can, yeah. It's not super loud, but
it's like a stopwatch, you know, the kind of we used to have at Feet First. And we had it's green. We just had it. We gave it to the kids to play with, and they somehow set the alarm on it, and we cannot figure out how to turn off the goddamn alarm.
I don't know how they do that. Like Cormac, I sat him down at the computer just to let him play with letters, and I just opened up a Word doc and just let him kind of type and play with letters. It took him 30 seconds to find some function in Word that I've never found in 20 years of working with that software.
Yeah.
Kids are amazing.
Amazing.
So they're in Napoleon's theater.
There's a pretty good lengthy scene of Napoleon and showing how, you know, he's kind of an asshole and he definitely has a Napoleon complex about his height. And, you know, he's in the middle of a war, but yet all he wants to do is watch theater, and he's very picky about his theater.
He wants to watch short people hitting themselves. That's more specific.
Yes.
So the six little people and Kevin put on a show. They entertain him. The Napoleon makes the six little people generals and invites the seven of them, including Kevin, to his dining room, where he gets drunk, passes out, and the little people and Kevin steal all of his treasures.
Including his gold hand.
Was that a thing? Did Napoleon have a fake hand?
No. I think he had a gimpy hand. I know there's pictures of him with his hand tucked into his shirt because it wasn't quite, something happened. But I've heard also, I don't know, I won't go into that crap. But there's definitely, yeah, some precedence for Napoleon having a weird hand, and they just really ran with it.
So the heist, is that the right word, is successful. They get all this stuff. They put it in a big sack, and they go through a time hole door, which opens vertically like a garage door. Sometimes the doors can be opened vertically. Sometimes they're horizontal above your head, you know, when you fall through them. So there's, you know, there's different kinds of doors or holes. And they go through a door and end up in England during the Middle Ages.
1296-ish. They mentioned it was, yes, 500 years before the Napoleon situation.
Right. And they happen to be in the time or the realm of Robin Hood.
And they immediately run into olive oil. Like, that's the only way to describe Shelley Duvall's character, is she is still stuck in her olive oil character.
Is that who played olive oil, that actress?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That was a good casting for that role for her. So then proceeds a long scene of them meeting up with Robin Hood's gang and convincing them that they're also robbers, and then meeting Robin Hood, and then Robin Hood essentially stealing all their loot that they stole from Napoleon, and they end up with nothing.
Well, he doesn't steal it. He redistributes it amongst the poor, as Robin Hood is alleged to do.
Right, right. But I mean, the little people did not want to give their loot away.
No.
But they did.
And was it Cleese that was Robin Hood?
Yes.
Yeah, that was funny. That was when I knew we were in for a very interesting ride. Because up until then, it was a little bit silly, but not straight up.
You called it. This is a Monty Python film.
Yeah.
This is Monty Python Does Time Travel. It felt like a bunch of skits. Like, yeah, the fact of Napoleon, and he just wants to watch like short puppets get hit. We're like, okay, we're not delving too much into serious science fiction or history here.
So have we seen the evil one yet?
The evil one?
Yeah.
Maybe.
Not quite.
Yeah. So eventually they show a guy with weird headpiece who refers to himself as the evil one. And, you know, without saying it, they're alluding to the fact that this is the devil, the opposite of good, the destroyer, the evil one.
And that's all he was put on this earth to do. And he knows that that's just his job, and sometimes he takes it seriously, sometimes he doesn't, but his goal in this universe is to be the opposite of the creator who...
Right, and he is trapped in whatever place he is in by the Supreme Being, and he knows of the map, and he wants to obtain the map so that he can get out of this place he's in and turn the universe or the world, they never really say universe, turn the world in his image or something like that.
Evil,
yeah. So they decide to somehow get those seven characters into their realm. He kind of possesses one of the little people and talks through him and says, there is a place that has the greatest item ever found. Are we skipping ahead?
No, this is about, I'm trying to think if this happens in Greece. Do we go to Greece first? Or does
they go to Greece first with Agamemnon.
So, that's right, because this is when they get separated, because the evil one speaks through him after Kevin.
After Robin Hood, they go, Kevin, he goes through a separate door. And he ends up in Greece meeting King Agamemnon.
Or known as Alexander the Great.
Bingo.
So he's there. And then, you know, there's a scene with Sean Connery being... He's not Alexander the Great?
No.
Oh, I thought we looked it up.
Agamemnon.
So Exactly. So then there's a scene of where, like, he wants to become... or. King Agamemnon wants Kevin to be like his son. So, and Kevin is all for that. He's like, yep, I want to be this guy's son. I want to stay here. This is super cool. He's all for staying there. And then the six little people show up and they steal his crown and they're pretending to do an act in the court of everybody. And they drag the kid onto stage and then go into a portal with, and then there's smoke and they disappear and they took the kid with him against his will. And then they're on the Titanic and Kevin is sulking because he wanted to stay in Greece.
And Shelley Duvall shows back up again.
She's kind of useless in this movie.
They just pop up as like lovers in different eras, I guess, that have the same issues.
That's what I couldn't tell. Oh, I guess, time-wise, that's not even close. I don't know
why. They were in the Robin Hood era as, like, this affluent couple that is super high society and kind of hoity-toity, and they get overtaken, and now they pop up, same people in a totally different era, totally different location.
Yeah.
It's a Monty Python show. It's just a callback joke.
I didn't do the math right away. As I was watching, I just assumed that it was the exact same character later on the ship. But yeah, that's 600 years later. So
yeah,
and she's still dealing with she's damned for eternity to be with idiots.
This guy,
with douchebag.
Except I think they were suggesting he had a penis problem earlier, and now he's got a nose problem.
Yeah,
it's a Monty Python skit.
Yeah. Yeah.
Sorry, science. You can take a week off.
We're going for the laughs. So they're on the Titanic. They don't realize that. And someone makes some ice joke. And then, boom, the Titanic goes down.
Yeah. And they are floating in the water on a piece of the ship. And... all of a sudden, the water starts to turn, you know, because the evil guy has a big bowl of water and he's like casting a spell through it or something. And he like twirls the water. And all of a sudden, this is where it gets weird.
Oh, this is where it gets weird.
They get like, you know, this, I don't know what you would call this special effect for the movie, but it's like... opposite color, black and white or something. And
they kind of get flushed and then they fall.
They're pulled out of the water and then they're dropped back in, like they just reverse the footage and they're dropped back in the water. And now they're in this weird realm. They're in, I guess it's supposed to be this place where the evil guy is trapped and they like brought him there. That's how I perceived it. So they have been brought to this place, but they kind of wanted to go there because, you know, the one that was being possessed by the evil guy told him about like this item, this amazing item.
The most fabulous object in the world.
Right. And so since these guys are thieves, they're like, let's do that. Let's go there. So they're okay with being there and they're all floating in the ocean. And here comes a big, ugly ship and now is a scene with an ogre on a ship with a terrible underbite, his fairly attractive wife, who's like conjuring up remedies to help this old ogre guy, and the seven of them are brought onto the boat, and I guess they're going to eat them. But instead of getting eaten, they're able to knock both the ogre and his wife overboard and take over the ship. And then
Talk about this silliness for a minute, because this was so...
Someone's got to talk about it.
So this ogre, yeah, he's supposed to be a big, scary ogre, but he's always complaining about how much his back hurts and how he can't scare people and how he's failing as an ogre. And his beautiful wife... it's killing me. Who's the boss? What's her name on Who's the Boss, Scott?
Oh, Helmand. She's Mona.
Mona! Yeah, hot Mona.
This is Catherine Helmand. Yeah, she's also in Brazil.
Yeah, she can live above my garage anytime.
Okay.
So, yeah, and she's you know, beautiful, and she's with this ogre, and she keeps on, you know, giving him the confidence of, like, you can do it. You're scary. Oh, look at these. We caught these little people. So go scare them and eat them and do your job. And instead, they fix his back and make him feel better. And I don't know why this bit just made me laugh. So I just had to stop and talk about it for a second. But these guys, being the evil interdimensional thieves that they are, throw them overboard and continue forward. And what happens to this ship? Ari.
So then all of a sudden the ship starts to raise up out of the water, and it turns out that this ship is a very stylish hat for a very large giant.
Yes.
And in what I thought was way too long of a scene, we see this giant slowly walk out of the water. Slowly.
So slow.
Slowly. I mean, I'm sure for the time this was like pretty cool to see in the special effects and yada, yada, yada. But anyway, he walks onto the shore and squashes some like little creature's house. I don't know. And then the way that they get off of the giant's head is by, I guess there's a hole in the bottom of the boat.
They rip some boards out of the boat so they can get to the giant's head.
And then they inject him with some sleeping water potion stuff. And the giant falls asleep, takes his little hat off and falls asleep, and they're able to run away. And then they come across, which was also interesting, a glass wall, a barrier. And they're about to give up and go back. And then one of them picks up a skull and crashes it through the glass. That was a cool effect. I liked that. And then they see this giant, scary, really big castle, and they go into the castle, and this is where the evil guy lives. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And they get captured. The seven men and
don't they
Kevin...
go straight into battle, or do they actually get captured for? I didn't.
Well, they're in that cage. The cage scene.
Oh gosh. Yeah. So there is the huge battle, and then the battle, and this is like an interdimensional battle. They got knights coming in from.
That's after
the cage.
Oh,
scene.
It is after the cage. Okay. Never mind.
They get captured, and they're in this cage, suspended in a black empty room, and they quite cleverly get out of the cage, use the rope that the cage is suspended with to swing themselves to another cage, and then swing themselves to a platform.
That was pretty impressive, right?
Yeah.
That was very cool.
That was the most intelligence this entire movie showed. Like, one swings to one cage, then they use the momentum to swing to the other cage, and the third one swings down, and then fourth one goes down, and then they make a zip line out of it.
Yeah.
Come on.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
That was the most impressive thing in the film.
Yeah, those are some smart thieves. So then proceeds the big battle. So they, in this one big room.
Well, real quick, just for the absurdity of this movie, which I think we have to lean on a little bit. So once they're all saved out of the cage, there's kind of like a little maze there. And at the end of this maze is Kevin's parents appear. And at the beginning of the movie, Kevin's parents are watching a game show called Your Money or Your Life. And so there's an episode of Your Money or Your Life taking place in front of them. And Kevin's parents are the contestants of this one. And I think Kevin knows. Does Kevin start screaming, it's a trap, it's a trap? Or because all the little people start running for it because they... they're certain at the end of this maze is where this amazing object might be. And then I can't remember exactly how, but it all dissolves into the evil one. And then the battle starts.
So the battle takes place in this one big room. And I noticed pretty on that a lot of the big stones and things were made to look like Legos.
Yes.
Yeah. So that immediately told me that this is, you know, filled with Kevin's toys. And that's kind of how it happens. They're about to do this big battle, and all of a sudden a bunch of cowboys on horses show up on Kevin's side, and a bunch of
a tank, a spaceship,
like some knights. Roman guys.
Yeah.
And so there's this big battle ensues, and they try to defeat the evil guy, and they do. They shoot him or something.
No, in the end, he's about to do something to them, and then he freezes into stone, and then the Supreme Being comes out.
Oh, yeah, it was the Supreme Being that, like, turned him into stone and kind of blew him up. And then the Supreme Being turns into some, like, older white guy. I don't know who he was.
Yeah, he's just a businessman.
They thought in 1981. They were pretty sure it was an old white guy.
He looks like a salesman for all of the appliances that his parents want to buy.
Yeah. And he says some stuff I don't remember and says you have to collect all the little pieces of the evil one because he is concentrated pure evil and throw them in a trash bin. And they do, except for one piece that they forgot about. And the one piece, it's like under the tank at the time, and it starts to glow hot as though it were still active. And then it's over. He says goodbye to his little people friends. And
well, I mean, also, we should probably point out that, yeah, the Supreme Being is pretty much saying that all of this, it was his doing and he knew all along. The fact that these bandits, they were supposed to be like fixing the time rifts and they took the map and stole it. He's kind of like, I'm the Supreme Being. Of course I knew what you were doing. Of course, I just let you run away, even though I warned you to do this. And I totally had control of the bad, of the evil all the whole time. And then you're like, well, then why do you let this? Whatever. Yes, that's revealed.
Yeah, it was almost like he was doing this as an experiment to see what would happen.
Right. He brings one of the bandits back to life. He turns the one bandit that became a pig back to being a bandit. And then he sends takes everyone away and sends the boy home.
Yeah. So sends the boy home. He wakes up in his bed and there's like a bunch of smoke everywhere. And it turns out that his house is on fire. And then some firemen come in and pull him out of the house. And his house is burning down and he's standing outside of his house with his parents. And his parents are more concerned about their kitchen appliances than their son or their house. And I guess the dad or somebody goes inside to save a kitchen appliance and he runs out with the toaster. And inside the toaster, it looks like I guess the dad or the mom, one of them had put something in the toaster and forgot about it and left it on. And that's what started the fire. So in the toaster, when they open it, is this chunk of charred something. And the scene that traumatized Scott's entire family when he was younger, mainly his sister, is the parents then put their hand in the toaster and touch the charred piece of whatever, which is the concentrated pure evil, and they explode right there on the spot and are dead. And Kevin is left with a burned house and no parents, and the end.
And Sean Connery, who was his surrogate father in Greece, is the fire chief.
So, right, if they went with that, if they were like, if he smiled and said, don't worry, boy, I'll take care of you, and they went off together, that would give you some form of a happy ending. But although we saw him, the fire truck leaves, boy is there, house is on fire, parents are dead, he's alone, camera pans up to show the whole town, the end. That's a bold move for 1981.
So I'm watching the beginning of this movie again because I usually have it playing in the background when we're doing this anyways, but I'm a little bit behind now. In his room, all over his room, there's a huge poster of Napoleon. There's a toy tank. There's toy knights. There's a spaceship toy that comes into play at the end. The tank and the spaceship are having a battle. So yeah, this is definitely all taking place in his imagination.
Yeah, and that's how I thought of it too.
Well, but then, oh, I see what you're saying. But then he wakes up with the fire. You're meant to think this is a dream. They even show some of the toys. But then outside the fire, he's finding the photos from his Polaroid. So that's the evidence that this adventure did happen.
That's right.
Plus the toast existed, which is like from that world. So it's funny though, that like, you're not that upset because he kind of hated his parents. Like it's like he's trading up somehow, but it's still a very weird ending.
Yeah. Cause his parents weren't awful. Like they were definitely, you know, absent a little bit, but
they were pretty bad.
No, they weren't.
So interesting take on the movie here, obviously, as Desmond, as you were saying, when they end up in the maze in the bad world, they're showing the most fabulous item. And it's like the same like voiceover of the appliance commercial that the parents are obsessed with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was even the same salesman that's like this person, this like devil's disciple. So which is suggesting in this film that they just think technology is like the root of evil. And that's why the parents are just so obsessed with toasters and gadgets. They don't pay attention to their own kid. And that's the devil's work apparently. And that's kind of seems to be some underlying theme.
That's right. And the evil one was obsessed with learning about computers. Remember, he was like trying to get his little minions to teach him about all the different types of computer things.
Okay.
Yep.
So Terry Gilliam is saying technology is the death of imagination and kids are pure and adults are obsessed with technology and corrupt and evil. And we're just machines pretty much.
This movie's weird. The more we talk about it, the more I think like it was just a little absurd Monty Python movie when I was watching it. But now
it's not good. How about if that's the podcast? It's just us going, it's not good.
If this is 90 minutes, I think it's amazing. You know, I think it's a lot better. Like, I don't know why the pull to make this such a long movie. I mean, not that it's terribly long, but
113 minutes.
It had no business being 2 hours. This silly, silly romp. Oh, there's a big Lego, box of Lego in his room. More tanks.
I mean, if we take him looking at his photos as proof, part of the fantasy, then maybe that's more interesting. But you know, it zooms out at the end to show how it started, right? It shows the village is like a bunch of squares, and then it kind of goes into the map, the time space map, whatever. And then you see the hands of the supreme being just take that map and fold it up. So again, he's just kind of toying with us, and it is real. Or
how does this movie get made?
That's a different podcast.
It is. It's so.
Fun fact, did you see this, Des, that Apple bought the rights to it in July of 2018?
Yes.
To make a TV series on Apple TV?
Yeah.
With Taika Waititi as the director of the pilot?
Is that still happening? Or did, I mean, obviously they're not filming right now, but.
Yeah, interesting. This film did well. It was like number one in the box office for films, apparently. I mean, I grew up in that time period. I don't remember this being a big theater hit, but I was 6 years old. It was number one at the box office for a weekend, or remained number one for 4 weeks. His breakthrough hit in the US, yeah. And it's, for all the time travel movies you've done, this is a different beast.
This is barely a time travel movie.
Yeah.
I would have been happy if they had stuck with the theme of just traveling through history, but the minute they went into that weird realm is when they lost me.
Yeah, the end of this movie, it's all about the interdimensional battle between good and evil, and the traveling through time really had nothing to do with that. I mean, except for, yeah, it shows the gaps, the errors in the all-knowing, all-powerful being of the created universe.
So all this battle, and there was no battle, that the supreme being was just kind of like, I knew, I'm the supreme being. It's totally okay that you guys are running throughout time and disrupting the time continuum and stealing things and leaving him in other eras. Not a big deal.
Yeah, no consequences for the things they stole and brought to different eras.
Oh, there's a pig behind him. There's a big picture of a pig behind his head.
Oh, wow. So all those elements were in his room.
Yeah. Everything was
in his room. So that would be great if at the end they didn't bring the toast and have the Polaroid photos.
Yeah, if he just woke, or even if they did have the Polaroid photos. Oh, look at all those Lego on the ground. Yeah, just kind of have him wake up and we're all left to wonder if it's real or not. You know, maybe there's a rock of pure evil in his room just to kind of add your wonder to it. But yeah, the fact that this ends.
Maybe the kid becomes the supreme being and time has no meaning and he's just making himself. I'm trying to make this a lot more interesting.
Yeah, because what happens after this movie? He goes to foster care and his life gets probably worse than it is right now. Just
the sequel is just like him having time travel fantasies, being rescued from foster homes.
Yeah, and every adventure is a little bit different because he's in a new foster home with new toys and gadgets and pictures, and he gets lost in those worlds as well.
Yeah.
I
don't know what to tell. Here's what's interesting about this film. I mean, you guys like to examine what's unique about the films. And have you seen another time travel film that where the method is really just about riffs, mistakes in the space-time continuum, and just riffs that just exist in various points? That's unique, right?
I feel like we've had to, I mean, going back to episode one, I frequently ask questions, is probably the closest movie time travel-wise to this one.
Yeah, that's a good point.
As far as accidental, and that one turns out to be alternate universes more than time travel when right before the credits.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely some good ideas in here, and it got all thrown in Terry Gilliam's head and got shaken up and barfed out.
You know, it's got that quality as a movie. There's a few movies that are kind of made for kids, but they're like dark and with adult themes, you know, isn't there that one? Pan's Labyrinth, that is kind of like a kid's adventure, but it's not like to show your average six-year-old. And this is the same. This would be very exciting to any eight-year-old to watch this film. But considering like what happens at the end, it's a little too childlike for adults and it's a little too adult for children.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't know who the audience for this is.
Monty Python fans. I can't believe it. Because this is... so different from anything we've done. Like it's so random. There's no really real rules to latch onto. Is this, I mean, if you take this universe at the face value that we take it at, is this holeless, Ari?
No, it's not holeless. He stole the Mona Lisa from another time and brought it back into the past and is this essentially screwing up the timeline.
Yeah, that's the Mona Lisa is going to be discovered way before it was made, potentially.
But if what's happened has happened has always happened, all he's doing is what he's just playing out the adventure that the supreme being always supremed.
Well, I got the sense at the very end where they zoom out and then he rolls up the scroll or the map. I got the sense that was one of many maps, many worlds that he has created. Almost like a game to him, you know, like, let me put all these pieces together in this world and then try this experiment and see how it ends. And oh, now it's end. I'm going to roll it up and put it away. Like, it's not real. It's like a game to him.
Because you're right. He can pretty much snap his fingers and fix all of this.
Yeah. Anytime you have a supreme being,
it's God's game show.
Yeah, exactly.
Your life or your money. And if you were God and alive forever and ever, why not do this? This is as good as any chutes and ladders.
It's just like, if the supreme being has so much control, why was he so bad that he messed up the creation of the universe and needed to hire these guys to like fix it?
Well, they didn't fix it. I mean,
that was their job. They were supposed to fix the errors that, because he made the universe in seven days.
Oh, was that their...
Yeah, that's what their job was. The six little people,
they created trees and bushes. Also,
like little things. And the reason they got fired or something is because one of them made a red tree that smelled really bad.
That's right. Yeah.
And they got fired and they got angry, so they stole the map, and now they're just going through all the holes in the design to steal things.
I definitely like that idea. I like the idea of the universe being rushed in a way that it wasn't quite complete. You had to throw some stucco over some of the holes, and people eventually found.
But doesn't that contradict everything that God is supposed to be? He's supposed to be perfect, and he made everything perfect. It's all in his plan.
Well, this is the dirty little secret about God, Ari. He's not. If we are made in his image and we are imperfect, then why would he be above mistakes?
What?
I'm trying to read up on this. I'm like looking up like, what is with the ending? And no one's got an answer. They're like, we're pretty sure it's not been a dream, and yet there's questions in the air. Is God just covering his tracks by making it all seem like a dream, even if it wasn't? And that evil is like claiming his own when he claims their parents?
Essentially not really a time travel movie. I mean, a little bit.
you know, they're trying to say he was on his own most of the movie and he seemed happier that way than when he was at his parents' anyway. And with the fireman giving him the wink, we're hoping that he's just going to go off with them with the Agamemnon guy. But they don't do anything to further that idea. I'm sure my sister is not the only kid who saw this movie and got freaked out that their parents touched a piece of toast and died, and this poor kid's an orphan.
Yeah, and he, I just watched at the end, he kind of like, he's not sitting there like, ha ha ha, my parents are gonna die. Like, he's like, Mom, Dad, it's evil.
Yeah.
And then they explode, and Sean Connery drives off, and
the end.
There he is, just sitting in his robe.
Yeah, it's a strange ending for a film that's relatively silly and childlike and full of glee.
Fantasy.
I definitely came into this conversation confused and wondering, and usually once we start talking about it, things start to open up and make some sort of sense, you know, even if it's in a weird this universe sense. But the more we talk about this movie, the more totally absurd.
I thought they were going to do like a Bill and Ted's on us, you know, that the kid's really into history and he knows a lot and they keep going back to history and his knowledge saves them. And then that just got dropped. There's like no historical value. You know, all we know about Napoleon is that he's short, which we already knew that, you know.
And that's another point Scott brought up. Is Robin Hood a real person or was he just a story?
He's like a fictional folk hero, right? It's probably based off someone, maybe, but...
Yeah, I think there was a Robin Hood of Locksley, but yeah, I think he's been greatly exaggerated. Just like Jesus. Jesus was a real person, but, you know, just to go back on the whole God thing, but...
You guys are getting deep for a science-based podcast.
It's all the same answer, right? Give me some science to talk about, Scott.
Time and space, what does it all mean? You know, we might as well sometimes, some of those movies suggest religion and science. When you go to the end of both universes, you find the same answer there, right? Like Contact, Interstellar, 2001.
Something to...
If the Big Bang was there, what was before the Big Bang?
Interstellar pop.
Oh man, I'm getting so deep.
So, damn it, what was I going to say? So, does this map ultimately lead to... No, that's right, because the evil guy... Okay, so I can ask this question. So you have this map, and now they don't know where the holes go, right? Do they ever know?
I don't think so, because they're always surprised when they get there. Like, I guess one of the holes led to Kevin's closet, to his room, and they didn't know that.
But knowing that, then how would you ever get back home if you can never see where it goes? Or do you just accept that you're never... Is this like quantum leap for...
It is. You hope that your next door is the doorway home.
So I don't know if that boy realized when he joined them, he was potentially never going to be home again. I mean, I guess he didn't care. His parents are obsessed with toasters. What does he care?
He was running from the evil head, so.
Yeah, he didn't have an option.
This reminded me, the evil head reminded me of another Sean Connery classic.
What?
Zardoz.
Oh, yeah, Zardoz. That's Ari's favorite movie of all time.
Ari loves Zardoz.
No.
I think Zardoz makes more sense for this podcast than Time Bandits did.
I think you might be right.
Thank you for listening to Time Pop, brought to you by Sounds Awesome. Please like and subscribe and tell a neighbor or friend about it so you can share a discussion of your own on the topic of this movie. Please check us out on social media. We are at What Sounds Awesome on Facebook and Instagram, and at Sounds Awesome 2 on Twitter. You can email us directly with questions and comments at wesoundawesome@gmail.com. We would love to read your thoughts aloud on air, and definitely let us know about a movie you would like featured on a future episode. Apocalypse Now, where Scott, Callum, and Dez talk about apocalypse-ish movies. Movies about society going through a difficult situation, not unlike the one we are currently living through. Want to check out some non-movie-related podcasts? Check out All the Answers. You have questions? The Record Keepers have answers? Cassidy and Katie have sassy comments? Who are the Record Keepers? You'll have to listen to find out. And our newest addition to the Sounds Awesome family, Truth Not Trends. Liam Bauer and Jesse Schmidt have a combined 35 years of strength training, and they are here to keep you strong, fit, and motivated through these difficult times. Please visit our website at whatsoundsawesome.com to find all these fine podcasts. or just search Sounds Awesome in your podcaster of choice to find these fine shows. Please rate and review. And now, back to the exciting conclusion of this episode. Okay, you've got this map. Do you use it?
No.
What if one of the doors is the doorway into the future, Ari? You never know. You try enough doors, you might end up in the future.
No, I didn't like this movie, so no.
I love this idea of like gambling time travel. Like there's just some doors. I don't know where it's going to go. Let's see what happens.
Yeah. Yeah, this is another one in the long list of time travel things that if I'm a lonely old man, I go ham on this map. But, you know, as a loving husband and father, I just can't take these. Oh, we got a stinger scene. Huh?
What?
It's actually not really a stinger. It just shows them back in the woods and Kevin taking Polaroids of them, but it's all in red.
By the way, is it arguable that this film is supposed to take place in the future with the inventions and the kind of stuff they were discussing at the parents' house?
Oh,
they never say.
Because there were some inventions that like we hadn't had yet. This was in 1981. You know, there was some like it makes your food in only 15 seconds. Or like, well, mine makes it in 8 seconds.
Yeah. No, because I think if that were true, I think they definitely would have traveled to what would be considered now, I bet. I feel like they would have ended up in the 80s.
I'm just trying to find some more meaning in this freaking film.
Yeah.
Technology is the enemy. That much I got.
I'm glad I watched this movie. I can't believe I haven't watched it until now. And, you know, it's a great Monty Python movie. It's got some interesting little things in it. But it just, it dies in Terry Gilliam's crazy mind.
Yeah, I think this is like that halfway point. It's exactly that between Monty Python and then the films that Terry Gilliam would go on to make. Even Brazil it's wacky, but definitely more serious subtext in there and more satire. And this is somewhere in between.
Yeah, I think I think our downfall with this movie is thinking we were going to watch a time travel movie. I think if you just want to see a Terry Gilliam flick, I think this hits on all cylinders. But if you want to see a time travel movie, this falls pretty flat.
Except that this shows up pretty high on the list of any time when we search for time travel movies. This is, you know, towards the top of the ones you must see.
Yeah, and I think it's just because it's a good movie. It's an okay movie, and it just happens to have time travel in it. So there's just a crossover there. I'm like, oh, this is good. Oh, and it's time travel.
Yeah, it's very creative. All the miniature, like a lot of the visions they do, like Ari said, of the hallway that keeps extending and these cages that come out of nowhere and these castles and the boats and the war in the Napoleonic era was very creative. Again, it's like too adult for kids, too kid-like for adults.
So this was a great movie with time travel, not a great time travel movie.
There you go.
Exactly.
Until next time, I am Desmond McNeese.
I'm Ariel Galah.
Also Scott Lifton.
Bye.
That sounds awesome.
Cool.
Sounds Awesome. That sounds like a good name for a company.
That was a Sounds Awesome production.